Hey everyone, it's Rich. Back in February of this year, a ransomware attack on Change Healthcare exposed the private health information of its customers. Well, just the other day, the health tech company's owner, United Health Group, finally revealed just how many people were impacted by the data breach. More than 100 million. And it only took them 8 months to tell us. In this episode, I discuss the challenges around securing personal data in the healthcare sector with Saima Fancy. Saima is a senior privacy specialist at Ontario Health in Canada. She says that managing a successful cybersecurity program in the healthcare industry begins with simply knowing where your data is. Sounds like a no-brainer, right? Well, according to Saima, approximately 80% of the world's data is unstructured. That means the overwhelming majority of the world's data is stored in a way that can't be easily categorized, managed, and protected. And this includes medical records. Saima operates at the intersection of engineering, law and policy, and cybersecurity, as she helps cross-functional teams build systems that better protect people's sensitive health data. She admits that conducting privacy impact assessments is no easy job. Product teams want to push products out the door as fast as possible. But as a privacy professional, Simon knows that in today's world, products must be built with the mindset of privacy by design. We also touch on the topics of smart devices and AI, and the ongoing issue of digital footprints. Now, I want to be clear, Simon doesn't fear technology. In fact, she's kind of an optimist. She even uses a smartwatch. But what Saima does underscore is that the trick is to make technology work for you.
You're listening to Privacy Files. This episode is brought to you by Anonymy Labs, makers of MySudo, the world's only all-in-one privacy app, and Sudo Platform, the cloud-based platform companies turn to for seamlessly integrating identity protection solutions into their software. And have you heard about the MySudo web browser extension? Breaking your online data trail just got way easier. To learn more, visit mysudo.com. That's mysudo.com.
Saima, welcome to Privacy Files.
Oh, thank you so much. So happy to be here.
Yeah, great to have you. So you're currently a senior privacy specialist at Ontario Health in Ontario, Canada. And I'd love to hear a little bit about what that job entails.
Yeah, so Ontario, along with all the other provinces in Canada, provide free healthcare, as the world knows, as far as Canadian healthcare system goes. And in Ontario specifically, similarly to the other provinces, what that means is that when you use your health card, your health information is collected and the government basically endeavors to protect it. So we at Ontario Health work as an agency to the Ministry of Health to exact that exact mandate. So I work alongside my fellow privacy cyber architectural professionals to do exactly that, protect the data, protect the cloud architecture that hosts that data.
Yeah, when we think about data privacy, I mean, of course, there's like, you know, healthcare is, that is the pinnacle of all sensitive data that you really want to protect. And so this is why it's so interesting to talk to you about this topic, because there's obviously people have a vested interest in ensuring that their health information is private. And yet when you hear about data breaches all the time, virtually every week now, sometimes those data breaches involve healthcare companies.
Exactly. It's true. It's happening more often than not, and not just in Canada, but all across the world. I think it's partially because of a lot of hospital and healthcare facilities are hosting cloud infrastructures that are based on legacy systems. You know, you've got leaky APIs that aren't being patched up. You've got infrastructure within the cloud that's not being updated. Updates are not happening on different SaaS platforms, right? And so with all, and don't forget good old fashioned ransomware and spamware. Right? A lot of employees are guilty of clicking that one click they should not have clicked, and boom, that's it. Your bad guys are into your system. So there's a lot of that happening. Monies need to be poured into fixing the cloud architecture for the most part, and then educating employees as well, of course. And then with the onset of all the LLM tools that we have, how are we teaching healthcare providers all across North America and the world on how you use them to help facilitate your work, but at the same time, be mindful of the information you're feeding the chatbots, right? It doesn't matter if it's ChatGPT, it's Perplexity, if it's any of them, Claude, doesn't matter. Because once that data is out, it's out. You can never take it back.
What about in general? I mean, you've had a chance, I guess, to kind of get a feel for the healthcare industry overall as it pertains to cybersecurity. Where do you feel like the healthcare industry overall, let's say in North America, where does it stand in terms of how robust their cybersecurity measures are? Is there a lot to be improved, or you kind of feel like you're on the right track?
There's a lot of room for improvement. Problem number one, know where your data is. It's such a simple problem, you would think, but it's one that's quite prevalent. And it's not just healthcare facilities that are guilty of it. A lot of orgs that are sitting on terabytes and petabytes of data don't know where that data is residing. For the most part, do your data inventory, then figure out what kind of data do you have. We talked about before the show began, unstructured versus structured data. If that's the case, get a hold of tools that will classify the data, then tag it, then label it, then and catalog it. And what that means is then you're able to take all these pieces of data sets and you're able to classify them as PII, PHI. This is social insurance numbers. This is credit card numbers. And on goes, you know, IP addresses, digital identities, and then you're able to cluster them. And using machine learning tools, you can allow your models to learn to classify that data on an ongoing dynamic basis because data is quite complicated, right? It has so many facets to it. That is not happening at large because these tools are expensive and companies are not wanting to invest the dollars that are required. Hence the massive amount of cyber breaches, and they're going to continue to happen until such measures are taking place.
And when you mentioned that 80% of the world's data is unstructured, you're saying that the data just doesn't have the proper attribute information attached to it so that you can properly classify, categorize, and do the proper data management.
20% of, and these are very general high-level numbers, are structured data, meaning you've got columns and rows and tables, and it's properly structured such that your tools can understand you, the human in the loop can understand what you're looking at, but a good chunk of it is not understandable. So let's get at that first, because once you do that, then you know where it's located. Then you know what it is, what's the sensitivity of it. If it's confidential, it's restricted, it's public access, crown jewels of your company. And then once you do that, then you can geolocate the data. So if you're an international global company, then you can figure out, okay, is this data pertaining to EU clients? Yes, GDPR applies. Is in India? Yes, then so-and-so law applies, and on it goes. Then you can protect the data from a global perspective. But until you do this one exercise, how do you protect it?
When you're talking about structured data, who is typically responsible for that in a larger organization?
The organization at large, right? It's the onus is on the entire org to do it. And now you're talking about accountabilities. I mean, right now the organization is the one that's being punitively held accountable when it comes to, for example, the EU, right? Uber just got slapped with 290 billion euros of fines for transferring data for EU citizens from the EU to the US where they didn't have such consent to do so, right? So that's one part of it. Holding officials accountable, we're not there yet. I think that's going to end up happening eventually because it doesn't look like that message is being perpetuated and proper actions are taking place to protect the data.
Yeah, and obviously the entire leadership should be held accountable. But I guess my question is it the CTO? Is it the CIO? Is it the CISO? There's somebody who has to be a champion within that organization.
Champion, yes. Accountability is not lying with a particular individual right now. You don't have the chief officers of all kinds being held accountable for that. But the company at large is being held accountable, right? For when GDPR-related fines go in place, that's at most at the top end, 4% of GDP is a fine is a penalty that's being handed down to big corps, right? That is starting to become a deterrent. And now with the AI Act going in as robustly as GDPR, that's going to cause shakers and movers to rethink about how they are doing business, which is a good thing.
I think on your LinkedIn profile, you talk about focusing on this intersection between engineering, law and policy, and cybersecurity. Can you explain a little bit more in detail what that means? How challenging is that to bring those three areas together?
Yeah. Challenging, yes. Impossible, no. So I always use the analogy that data that needs to be protected is, I use a metaphor of a bird. The body of the bird is the data. One wing is the privacy, protecting that data. The other one is security, protecting the data, the cybersecurity. One cannot function without the other. Hence, the bird cannot fly. And now you've got the overarching bubble around the bird, which is called AI. That's also can be employed to protect this bird, right? Privacy talks about data protection. Security does data protection, right? Meaning the tools are where cybersecurity comes into play. I think a privacy professional should know a bit of both. And that's where I'm constantly striving to learn more and more. I'm by no means am an expert. I can't call myself an expert because there's so much more for me to learn. This space is ever evolving, so dynamic. Put artificial intelligence tools with it, right? There's so much more to do and to learn. It's super exciting though.
So now you brought up AI, so you know I'm going to have to talk about that.
Of course you are.
So what is your perspective at this point, kind of the where we are right now in the evolution of AI? How, obviously there's a lot of benefit to it, but there's downsides, of course, with respect to these large language models that are collecting all this information. Companies are being very careful trying to get employees to realize that you shouldn't be sharing any proprietary information in those models. What are you seeing right now, and where are your concerns focused?
Yeah. So first, I'm going to tell you, I'm a techno-optimist. I am super excited about the stage in life that we're in as humanity. As with any technological innovation, for example, when seatbelts first came out, people were shouting and screaming like, no, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to take a few seconds out to put that together. You know, it was a matter of education when motor vehicle companies came out and said, look, you put the seatbelt on, it's going to protect you. You're not going to die when you have a car accident. Similarly, it's a matter of educating, right? Tell people how to use these tools, how to use them to protect you. Yeah, if you don't use them properly, there's definitely a lot of harms that you can face. Just like with any kind of tooling that humanity has faced, this is no different. A knife can be used to hurt someone. A knife can be used to cut your vegetables and fruit. Choose your pain, right? That's the point of view that I come from. But with that comes a great responsibility for those folks like us, like you and I, who are in this position to advocate for these tools and at the same time educate the public at large. So for example, everyone's ready and willing to hand their 1 and 2 year olds their cell phones. To me, that's akin to letting your kid cross the street with the moving traffic. Why would you do that? The 1, 2 year old doesn't know the dangers of the cell phone. I mean, it's an AI tool, essentially, that your kid's going to get hooked onto without understanding any precautionary measures. My take is, let's bring education into elementary schools. Let's make it mandatory. Let's teach children about their human rights as far as digital protections are concerned and how to use these tools responsibly. And definitely teach how LLMs, Gen AI, NLP tools work from the get-go. Kids are really smart. Look at how quickly they pick up all these digital devices that we have. Our whole homes have been turned into smart gadgetry at large, right? I mean, just think of how many gadgets you have in your home that are smart tech. It's crazy. And then the other part of this is that because it's getting so complicated and it's really daunting on one's psychological well-being, I say minimize your digital footprint. There's no need for me to hook my cell phone onto my stove or my fridge. I'm just going to use it old school, right? My smartwatch, I don't have it on right now. I only use it when I work out just so that I can get my biometrics for myself, right? And I know that data is being fed into XYZ company. But, you know, I'm intelligently making that smart off decision. That's my message. Minimize your digital footprint. Learn how to use these tools to assist you.
Let's take a quick break for this message from our sponsor.
All ready to check out?
Yes, I loved the new summer collection.
It's so good, right? Before I ring you up, were you interested in joining our loyalty program for future discounts?
Oh yeah, that sounds awesome. How do I sign up?
Awesome, I can sign you up right now. I just need a few things from you.
Okay, that sounds great.
Okay, first thing I need is your
full name.
I'm sorry, what was that?
Sorry, I just need your
full name.
Oh, okay, it's Anna Paulus.
Perfect. Next thing I need is your
phone number.
Excuse me?
Sorry about that. What's your
phone number?
Do you really need that for my account?
I really need your
email.
On second thought, I think I'm good on the rewards program. Thanks, though.
You never know what will happen with your personal information. Next time you want to get the discounts and rewards, use a MySudo phone number and email to receive the benefits without compromising your privacy. Download MySudo today and have peace of mind knowing your personal information is secure. To learn more, visit MySudo.com. That's MySudo.com. Stay private.
Now, one of the things that you do in your job is, of course, conducting privacy impact assessments. And one of the questions I had for you is that I hear this phrase oftentimes that they say privacy by design, but what does that really mean? What is involved in building things with privacy first in mind?
Right. So let's take principle number one of privacy by design. Be proactive, not reactive. So in the beginning of our talk, we talked about what does it mean to protect data. Proactive measure would be go buy the tools such as CSPM and DSPM, install them on your cloud infrastructure, figure out how to protect your cloud infrastructure, find out if there are leaky APIs, find out if there are backdoors that are left open, find out if you've got vendors doing POC that you never hired, but you never kicked them out of your cloud structure and they have access to like 50 gigabytes or petabytes of your data. Find these things out, do inventory, do data mapping, do lineage, figure out what the geolocation of each data point is, number one. Then number two, protect the data. This is called being proactive. Don't wait till you have a breach and then you go back and do all these things, right? That's what it means to embed privacy by design principles. And then you go on and on with the remaining six similarly.
I talk to people once in a while too that they're interested in having a career in privacy. And I'm curious, like, what does it look like day to day for you? You're probably involved in cross-functional team meetings all the time, making sure that privacy has a voice and a say and things that are being developed. But I'm just interested, I guess, in what does that logistically look like for you?
Yeah, it's such an amazing field. I have a lot of mentees I mentor and encourage to enter not just privacy, but cybersecurity as well. And then definitely educate themselves on how to use artificial intelligence, LLM tools to help them in their career. But yes, what this profession entails is wearing a lot of different hats. So with myself, having an engineering background, having a degree in biochemistry as well, and having worked in civil litigation, I bring all those skills and transfer them onto the space of data privacy and cybersecurity. No 2 days are alike. For example, when I was at Twitter, it was such a whirlwind of activities in protecting all these tweets that were coming in, a lot of them heavily laden with very sensitive information, you know, trying to figure out what the geolocation of the tweets were, how do we protect them, who do we deal with, looking at code scans and protecting. That's another proactive measure, by the way. When you've got a lot of coding happening within your infrastructure, go scan those codes to see if there are any privacy and security infractions. So that I digress over there. But it is an amazing profession that requires you to be skilled in being able to communicate all these facets to everyone who's at the table. But I have to tell you, to bring everybody at the table is so difficult. That culture needs to be adopted from top down. And we get a lot of pushback at work. You privacy folks, you just hold us back. We are an annoyance. And we keep telling them we're enablers. We're causing the organization to do things correctly. But, you know, a lot of project teams, product teams, they just want to get the product out, push, push, push. And we have to do all these assessments and say, no, whoa, hold on, right? And not a very synergistic relationship at all times.
What is that like? I mean, you obviously, I guess you have to have a little bit of skill and diplomacy too, because I can understand, you know, developers want to get things done and you're just like, oh, Simon, you're just slowing things down again. And so you really have to keep that, I guess you have to keep the bigger picture top of mind for people so that they understand why you're so regimented and vigilant about making sure that you're following the proper protocols.
It's about doing the right thing. And at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what someone else is saying to you. You chose to be in this profession to do the right thing. There's a whole philanthropy and philosophy behind being a privacy and security professional when it comes to data. I mean, if you're not going to do the right thing, then leave. Just don't do it. But what that means, it's not going to be an easy day for you. You are going to have to push back and say, no, I'm not going to sign up on this PIA. I'm just not, until XYZ criteria are satisfied, right? But to be able to have that voice and be able to speak up, yeah, it requires strength. And some days are super frustrating. And I've had this experience through all my past jobs as well. This is not just one particular company. And a lot of my fellow privacy professionals say the same thing. It's a tough one.
I bet it makes for some interesting meetings.
Yes, it does. But you know, the best meetings are the ones where so many of us from different facets of the company are together and we get it. We understand it, right? But at the times, the sell is so difficult. Those who are blind to it will not see it, period.
And so, I mean, ultimately, your job is really to mitigate that risk for the company, right? I mean, that's really what your job is. And I guess it's tough to get that on top of the mind of developers, like you said, when they're trying to push stuff out the door.
Right. So at the end of the day, what you do is you outline the risk. And if push comes to shove, then you say, okay, I have outlined my risk. I've told you why I'm concerned. Now you go find someone who's going to absorb these risks and will take responsibility and sign off, because it ain't going to be me. And that's what it comes down to.
Do you have any feel for kind of where Canada is versus the United States in terms of, you know, just overall, not just privacy laws, but
but where things are in terms of how the companies are, you know, moving forward to take better care and protection of personal data. I don't know if you have a feel for that.
Yeah. I a little bit I do because of my experience with Twitter, my experience in doing a lot of talks in the U.S. and a lot of my education being in the U.S. I'm not going to say I'm an expert. I hesitate to use that word, but I'll share with you my experiences. And that is, yes, in Canada, we have a federal law, but it's old. It's from 2004, before even internet hit most households. It needs a revamp really fast. It has one, but it's in second reading in Parliament and it's stalled. So I don't know when it's going to have life. In the U.S., you don't have federal laws at all. But what you do have is 14 states with robust privacy laws. California leading the way. I call it baby GDPR. That's CCP and CPRA. It's good. It's being right. It's being used accurately for the most part. HIPAA has its problems, but it's still a strong piece of legislation. That's a federal legislation. And you've got your AI Act coming down the pipeline soon. Here in Canada, the AI Act fell through the cracks. We won't see daylight for another year and a half or so. So it's a tough one. I want to say in a lot of ways, US is ahead of us. And then the other thing is, in terms of innovation, US is way, way ahead of us. Way ahead of us. The things that are being created, I mean, just look at some of the top tech companies. Where are they? They're in Austin, they're in San Francisco, a lot of them are in Lehigh, you know, they're in Boston, in Seattle. US is the place that's the harbinger of such fantastic thought processes and innovation and technological advances. I mean, I'm in awe in what the country's producing. And we have a lot of talent in Canada, but you know what? US companies come and gobble them up. They have taken a lot of our really smart kids, our engineers, working for Tesla, Netflix, Uber, and that is A-okay, but it leaves Canada in the dust, in the U.S.'s dust.
I've mentioned a few times on the show that I did interview an individual who had at least 30 years of experience in cybersecurity, and I think he was based out of London. He mentioned this interesting paradox where companies collectively have never spent more money on cybersecurity, but yet we've never seen more data leaks than we are seeing now. And it's like, there's obviously something going on here. And I thought maybe I'd ask you to see if you had some insight onto what you think might be the issues that we're facing.
Well, London, UK?
Correct. Yeah. But yeah. just talking globally about the issue.
Yeah. No, a fair point. Now, I don't know how much money is being spent in the UK at large on cybersecurity itself. In Canada, we're lagging in the spend, hence so many attacks that we do have. But perhaps it's because they're still not looking at the root problem, which is fixing up their infrastructure, right? Which is fixing up their cloud infrastructure, which is looking at where their data is. You can buy all the cybersecurity tools you want, but something as fundamental as, do you even know where your data is? Do you know what format it's in? Is it scattered across public cloud, private cloud, and on-prem? Is it a kit and caboodle of things? Where are the data centers? These fundamental questions, if they're not going to be addressed, you can throw all the bandages you want on it. It's still going to bleed the wound, right? That's my take on it.
I hear the term privacy engineer used a lot. What does that mean?
What you just said 5 minutes ago. Bringing people who can speak the language of many different stakeholders. That's what I aspire to be as a privacy engineer. I've done a few certifications in that in the US. And in Twitter, I was working as a privacy engineer tier two. And what that is somebody who can talk to engineering, architectural, system designers, DevOps, SecOps people, legal, policy, data governance, architecture, comms, marketing, all of them, and be able to convey the message in all their individual languages.
Sounds like
it's that one person or team that's the glue between all these groups and is able to bring them on the table together. I'd like to be that person.
Easy job, right?
I am that person.
That's an easy job, right?
No, and you know, when you do, and for those of us who are fortunate enough to have experience in life sciences, in engineering, in law, in policy, and all of which I've had, you can transfer those skills and bring them into this niche space called privacy engineering, which, by the way, is not that old. One of the first companies to employ privacy engineers, in air quotes, was Google. And the first university to teach privacy engineering as a program, and now all the way up to PhD, is Carnegie Mellon, which is fantastic. I'm going to be actually guest lecturing there in November in their privacy engineering program.
Oh, that's good. A lot of the topics that we touch on the show really are ultimately geared toward the individual at some point. And I always love getting the perspective from the corporate side, and especially for someone like yourself who's working really hard to help protect people's data. Given what you know at this point and what you've seen, not just where you currently work, but in past roles as well, what would you say, you know, to the individual who's looking to get their start in privacy? Where do they start?
They started on LinkedIn, number one. They start setting up, they start to follow the right people. They have to read a lot. And if they think I've read enough, they're wrong. They need to read some more. They need to reach out to the key people, reach out to them on LinkedIn, ask them for 15 minutes of their time just to say, hey, can I ask what you're doing in your space? What does privacy and cybersecurity mean to you? I'm trying to get into this space, just need a little bit of guidance. That's how I began. I had some very kind souls help me. And that's why my mandate in life is to pay that back, and hence the number of mentees that I'm mentoring right now. I also mentor through All Tech is Human. It's an area, because it's new, it's niche, it requires professionals to mentor younger ones, and we need to get more people in here into the space.
Let's take a quick break for this message from our sponsor.
Most people don't realize the weakest link in your digital privacy is your inbox. Deep down in the dark corners of the web, there are live auctions occurring.
Hey, over here, we got a phone number for sale right here, and over here, home address. Hey, wait, don't leave, come back.
I have the best list of usernames and passwords available. You want it? Come talk to me, I'll give you a fair pass.
I have credit cards, over here with the security number. They've all been tested. No one.
I got a full name and birthday combo right here, people. Who wants it? That's full name, birthday combo.
Yes, your personal information is being auctioned off, often without your knowledge. Every time a company experiences a data breach, your information could be up for grabs to the highest bidder.
Sold.
With Reclaim, you take your first step towards taking back control of your digital privacy. Reclaim works in three steps: scan, discover, remove. Imagine a world where you're in charge of your own privacy, where your information can be taken back. That's the world Reclaim helps create. To learn more, go to anonymy.com/reclaim and start your journey towards better privacy today.
What do you think the future holds? I know we see a lot of data breaches these days. I mean, a lot of major data breaches across all industries. And so I know people, you know, who are concerned about privacy are, understandably a little concerned. They're trying to do the best that they can to protect their data, but, you know, there are limitations, right? The world is digital today. You've got to live your life to some extent online. Do you feel like companies are doing a better job and we're going on the right track, getting there to better protect people's personal information?
Ooh, tough question. I think the awareness is there to do a better job. And I think slowly we're inching our way towards that, but we have a long way to go. And you're right. Data is just proliferating at an exponential rate. It's too late. All of our information's out there. From our individual perspectives, I say just minimize your digital footprint. Don't give out as much as you need to give out. But that alone is quite difficult. And then with the education piece that I was advocating for earlier, if we equip people with knowledge, children with knowledge, then they can mandate and demand that big tech protect their data, and they can ask for privacy policies. You know, Carnegie Mellon is working on privacy policies that are going to be shrunk down to essentially ingredient labels that you see in the back of your can of food, so that it's consumable and it's quick. So you no longer need a PhD to read one of those policies, right? It should be at a grade 5 level. If people become educated, they can demand these kinds of responses such that, you know, they get that protection. But until unless you educate people, that's not going to happen. And isn't that true of a lot of innovation that humanity's gone through, right? That we've educated people and people come back and demand protection. I mean, cigarette smoking, I mentioned knives, car seats, so many other things in our lives. So education is a giant piece of it. Let's make it mandatory in schools.
Yeah.
And let's get more universities to offer degrees in it.
Yeah. And like anything, you just have to keep working at it too. And I think you touched on it a little bit ago as well. And that is, we are collecting more data than ever. There's just more data, period. And just there's more opportunities for that data to leak.
Absolutely. It is out of control. I mean, look at our wearables, right? Look at our homes. Look at all the IoT devices. And when we make them interoperable, where our, you know, door ringer can talk to our phone, which can talk to our fridge, which can talk to our TV, you know, which can then monitor where our kids are going because we're surveilling them. Yeah, you're going to have something give. So maybe don't do that as a consumer.
Do you really need a toaster that's connected to the cloud?
Right. And I mean, do you really need Alexa to tell you constantly what the weather is like outside? You could, you know, stick your head out the door the good old fashioned way. Do you know what I'm saying? I'm just saying, I think we as a society are starting to become a little lazy too. And then yet we cry wolf. Well, you can't do that. If you want your data protected, then learn about it and maybe minimize your own digital footprint and don't share so much.
Exactly. And there's so many opportunities. We talk about it all the time on the show. Every time you go shopping, you know, I go somewhere, I go to the sporting goods store or whatever, and they're like, and your email and your phone number? And I'm like, I'm not giving it to you. Why do you need that?
Exactly. And airports, it's interesting when you ask me about the U.S.-Canada difference. Salt Lake City, San Francisco, New York, where else was I recently? All in this 1 year. Everywhere I declined to have my face scanned and eye scanned in the U.S., no problem. Do you think I can do that in Toronto? I was told to step aside when I said no in Canada, that we will deal with you accordingly. You know, it's going to take some time. You may miss your flight. But in the U.S., every time I declined, no problem. Yes, ma'am. Off you go.
That's right. I told the story recently that I came back from overseas. I think it was Europe. And my first port of entry into the U.S., back into the U.S., was Denver. And that was the first time I had seen the check-in through customs where they basically just took a picture of you. They never looked at my passport. And then the computer in a few seconds recognized me and said, hey, Rich, welcome back to the U.S. And that was it. I was like, that was weird.
But the computer said your name.
It already knew me. Yeah. All he did was take a picture of my face. They never looked at my passport. Yeah.
Yeah. So you're probably being surveilled throughout the airport as you're walking, right? And your information's being aggregated accordingly. But what I'm saying is it's interesting, perhaps it's a facade that in the U.S. I can say no to being scanned, but in Canada, I say no, and then there's repercussions for it. But at the same token, the result is the same in both countries. They still know about me.
And then you get, yeah, as soon as you say no, you get put on one of those lists where you get the SSSS on your boarding pass. And you get
exactly. Yeah, and then you're delayed and you're potentially going to miss your flight. And then you're like, oh, shucks, forget it. Fine, scan me. I need to catch my flight. I need to get to A to B.
Yeah, they hope over time they wear you down and you just have to participate. It's like I went for the longest time without a smartphone.
I find that to be an interesting contrast between the two countries, though. Yeah.
Very interesting. Yeah. Fascinating stuff. This has been fascinating. I really enjoy talking about this from the corporate angle. Is there anything else you wanted to cover before we go?
Only that I want more folks to enter this field. I want them to embrace the notion of knowing what their own protections mean in terms of their data, which is their biggest asset. It's more valuable than your jewelry, your oil, your home, and whatnot. And to be wise about how they share it. And to please, please educate your children, the elderly in your family, your neighbors, whatnot, right? I know I've got an elderly mother living with me. I mean, if it wasn't for me, she'd be clicking on every link that came her way, you know, giving her credit card number to anybody who called the phone. Even my elderly neighbors, now they know to come to me to ask me, is this real? Is this spam? What is this, right? The onus is on us in this industry to make sure we educate others and protect as much as we can.
Yeah, that's
those
right.
Those who are vulnerable, that is.
Yeah, AI is making the social engineering attacks a lot more believable.
And another takeaway that I have for you is, remember, AI is not an alien. It's a tool created by humans to control humans. We'll keep that in mind, that there's a human in the loop here in the beginning and at the end, right? If we can understand that, then we can better understand how to maneuver our way around these tools and with these tools. And also we need to keep in mind that this whole AI economy is bigger than we think, i.e. the data piece of it. AI is useless unless you've got corpus and massive amounts of data being fed into the tool, right? Where's that data coming from? People forget to think about that there is a full data colonization happening in countries like Bolivia, Colombia, India, Philippines, where people are being paid $2 a day to put in data into these tools, data that is horrific, profoundly disturbing. And these people are left so with such bad PTSD that they can never you can never unsee what you saw. When one forgets about that side of AI as well, there are so many humans involved here, right? And the more we keep that in mind, the more we can understand that this thing can't take over. We are in control, and it's being abused by those who we allow to abuse it and abuse us.
We've got a lot of work ahead of us.
We do. It's all a matter of talking about it and educating, and just like with any other piece of innovation, really.
Well, super. This has been awesome. So, Saima, I appreciate your time. Thanks so much for this.
Oh, thank you.
Well, that's going to do it for this episode of Privacy Files. If you'd like to be on the show, or you know someone who would be a good fit, head on over to privacyfiles.com and submit a guest request. Also, if you're enjoying the content we're cranking out, please consider giving us a 5-star rating in your favorite podcast player. It might seem like a small thing, but it does help others find us. These are people just like you, people who are on their own privacy journey. In our next episode, we'll be talking to Kevin Estella, one of the foremost experts on bushcraft and survival. Kevin is the author of the book, 101 Skills You Need to Survive in the Woods. He's also written more than 100 articles on the subject of survival and preparedness, and has served as a consultant for the History Channel. Among many items we'll be covering, Kevin will explain why personal privacy is so important for staying safe. Until next time, don't forget, privacy is a human right.